Accession number 20457, reel 29.
Brigadier Randall, reel 29.
Take the battalion, I think.
You're saying the battalion was back in Plymouth, having run Besley when you joined, and it had a low priority for manpower.
Yes, and then about 6 months or 4 months or so before I could take over command, it was down to two rifle companies, and then I was told that I would have to send one company's worth of soldiers on permanent posting to the Duke of Edinburgh's, because they were based in Malta, and they had a role for a fifth company. This was absolutely ghastly news. Fortunately, the director of infantry at that time was not only in my regiment, but I'd been his adjutant years before. So I asked to go and see him, and I said, look, this is disastrous, Sir General. Why can't I accept? I'm not arguing about the need, it's not for me to say, but could I not send a formed company on a separate detachment for 6 months? They'd keep their own cap badge and so on. They would be detached in Libya anyway. Mm-hmm. Rather than send a whole lot of soldiers, would be dispersed. Anyway, he fixed it. But soon after I took over command, I only had two rifle companies. One had to go off to Benghazi to carry out this role for the... And they were nominally... they were nominally part of the Duke of Edinburgh, but in fact, the Duke of Edinburgh had nothing to do with them. They were answerable to the full colonel commanding Tripoli district or Cyrenaica district. And... I only lost him for 6 months. So that was...
Did you actually go out and see this company while...
Yeah, I was all right. I went out and spent about a week or 10 days there, which was good value. And then, after that, there was quite a bad earthquake in Benghazi, and my company was able to do sterling stuff. Did a very, very good job in helping the local civilians and so on, which was good work.
What was their role in Benghazi? What were they supposed to be doing?
I think they were sort of... I'm not quite sure, really. There was the 14th, 20th Hussars were there.
Yes.
And I think that... I'm not quite sure what... The British Army uses as a training area. Exactly. I think the British Army was basically there to protect King Idris, who asked from what eventually happened to him, being thrown out by distance. Mm. They were sort of... They had no internal security role as such. I think they were there just to reassure Idris and to do training. And I think this company was the sort of infantry element of this small force in Benghazi under a full colonel.
What sort of training were they able to do? Could they do training for desert warfare?
Oh, yes, they did. Yes, I went out and exercised. It was quite good fun. I'd never done any fighting in the desert. Never done any exercises, so I enjoyed this actually. It was January, a very nice time of the year. It was a bright sunny days and cool nights, so it was very, very enjoyable.
Was this simply company level training, or were they part of a larger scheme?
I think this was just a company exercise, actually. They're doing a bit of field firing and a bit of one platoon against another with sort of a night with a sort of approach march and that sort of thing. Mm. Very low level stuff. But it was very good because
they were doing field firing, no
restrictions, nothing at all. They could more or less. And plenty of scope for, you weren't worrying where you were going to run out of the training area, or you mustn't take vehicles there, or something like that. None of those sort of restrictions you have to put up with in this country. So it was quite good training.
Was this training done near Benghazi itself, or were you off into the interior?
No, we were some distance, about 100 or so miles. There was a designated training area in the desert.
Yes.
Oh yes, yeah, we're definitely up there. Well, Bengali, there was a certain amount of cultivation and so on.
Mm.
And then, of course, there's a Jebel Akhtar up to the north. You couldn't go there. Now, this was a designated training area, roughly in the area of where some of the World War II fighting took place.
Did you get any sort of impression of the political atmosphere there at the time?
Obviously, very friendly. He walked about Benghazi. I mean, all the Arabs seemed to be stirring about there of an evening. There was no hostility, no, nothing like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was a very pleasant place to be. And my company thoroughly enjoyed their 6 months away from away from the CN's eagle eye, and at the same time, doing a reasonable part, knowing that they would be back at the end of 6 months. That was less than 6 months in the end. They only did about five, I think. And I got them back in the end.
It sounds like it was really rather unsatisfactory in a way, because you arrived to command a battalion and you'd got about half a battalion in terms of the number of companies. And it's often said that being the battalion commander is the best job you can do in the army.
Yeah, well, it was. I mean, really, just my bad luck. I mean, at one time I only had one company. But then what can I do? I can bellyache about it. We did go off on an exercise to Denmark.
With the one company?
Yeah, then I was given a company of Gurkhas, which was great fun. And we did this in the depth of winter in Denmark.
What were you doing up there? Do you remember the details of that exercise?
Well, I think the Danes had asked to have a British battalion over. They didn't want to send me originally because I was so weak, but in the end they were short of people, so they sent me over with this one company. And we did exercises with the Danish army. There was a We really took part in a Danish brigade exercise.
What impression did you get of the Danes?
Oh, well, they were charming people to meet socially. I mean, I thought that their military standards were pretty low. Well, in fact, I mean, we had to say, it was in January, and it was bloody cold, and it was quite tough in a way, and then we had to do a night attack. The Danish brigadier decided he'd attach himself to the town to see how the British did a night attack. Well, I'm afraid the objective, the Danes didn't think the British were going to do a night attack. I mean, they didn't do that sort of thing, the Danish army. So they were all held up fast asleep in their sleeping bags, and a whole battalion of them in this. Anyway, we came storming out of the night with all these Gurkhas. And it was very, I felt really rather embarrassed because these chaps were literally cowering back. They were terrified. They thought these Gurkhas were. But if you're fast asleep, all of a sudden they had on they hadn't drawn kukris on me, but it was a reputation of the Gurkhas. And I could see the Danish brigadier was torn between anger at the letdown and his embarrassment. So I had to play that very, very carefully indeed. But I mean, if it had been the real thing, we would have simply killed a freaking lot of them, actually. But on the other hand, they were very, very hospitable, very, very nice people, and they went out of their way to make us welcome and that sort of thing.
Do you remember which part of Denmark?
Yes, it was down in the south, Falster.
In the Jutland Peninsula?
What's the island? Zealand, isn't it?
Zealand.
Where Copenhagen is,
south
of Zealand.
Zealand, yes.
We were attached to the thing called the Falsterker Fod Regiment, which is the foot regiment of Falster, which is that area of the southern part of Zealand. In a place called Vordingborg.
What was their equipment like? What sort of
I think they had much the same. They had a bloody awful breakfast. We were in their barracks, and the vibes I got were the soldiers were quite happy, that they just couldn't stand this bloody awful Danish army breakfast. So the only thing to do was to sort of get some PRI funds and give them a pop. You think in Denmark you'd have bacon and eggs, wouldn't you?
Well, you'd think you'd have bacon at least.
Yeah, well, we got was, I don't know what it was now, but it was, anyway, my surgeon thought this is not, in the depth of winter, this wasn't, so we had to put that right, I remember that. And we had some great good, they were tremendous party chaps. They loved drinking whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
So night after night, they wanted to come into our mess. And so I had to split my officers into two teams, drinking teams. I had one lot, and then my second in command, we took it alternate nights. So. But, and they, we had to. I had a nightmare situation because in the middle of his exercise there was a break. The Danish brigadier had an enormous sort of banquet lunch in our honour in his Schloss, and it was very well done indeed. And we went there, I went there with a lot of officers, and this awful perilous business of giving you Carlsberg with schnapps chasers. And by the time we went into lunch, I'd had a pretty fair lot. And I was sitting opposite my second one. Anyway, about a 5 or 6 course meal, it was a magnificent lunch. Anyway, about the second course, they got up and said, gentlemen, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II of England. So we all did this. And then through my sort of alcoholic head, I realised...
You had to respond.
I had to respond. And, you know, I just couldn't think, what the hell the name of the King of Denmark? And I tried to get my second in command, but all he did was to sort of grin at So I thought, what the hell do you do? I could chicken out and say, His Majesty the King of Denmark, but I thought, no. Anyway, I thought, is it Olaf? Or is it somebody else? Anyway, but fortunately, my guardian angel was there and I got it right. But subsequently on the exercise, I met the British military attaché and I was telling him this awful business. I could see the sort of sea of faces now. I said, what would have happened if I got it wrong? He said, I can tell you this, you'd have been on a plane out pretty smartly. He said, the Danes would put up, accept any sort of military blunder in the field, but they wouldn't accept a sort of casual insult to their king.
Mm-hmm.
So Randall's career was on a knife edge. But yeah, I used to get, I don't know what we're doing, but I mean, several months after, I used to have a sort of nightmare. I'm standing out there, and all sea of expectant faces, and I got it wrong. Sorry to digress, but it's but anyway, they were a nice lot.
What were they practicing? You did a night attack on them. What was the sort of overall exercise scenario, as you
recall? Well, we were part of a. I think they had 2 weak battalions on the retreat, and we were the assaulting force trying to drive them back. And so,
so what
the setting of the exercise was that we were on the offensive.
So the assumption was that you know an enemy force had landed in Zeeland and they were trying to defend it. Was that
I think so, yes. Yeah. Well, they weren't going that way, I don't know. It was just the lie of the land.
Yeah.
The real trouble was, with only 2 companies, you really need a third.
Mm.
So at one stage I had 2 companies up, and then it was quite necessary for me to do a hook round the left. Well, I mean, normally I'd have a third company do it, but then all I had to do was rather ponderously withdraw this one of my companies in contact.
And push it around the flank.
Around. So I wasn't very happy about the situation, but it was. However, the Danes were quite happy, and we got on fighting well with them, which was after all the end of the exercise.
Mm.
And we had a final very good party, exchange of presents, and all that sort of thing. So it was achieved its object, I'm sure. At least I hope it did.
Mm. It sounds like you were out and about quite a bit. If you were out in Bengal,
then we moved to
to Denmark, and then.
Well, when we came back, we were in Plymouth, you see.
Yes.
And then we did a gate exercise, and then we were ordered. We had been ordered to go to Northern Ireland, which in those days was a sort of military blackwater.
Mm. What were you going to be doing there? Would you just have been part of the Northern Ireland
well,
garrison?
Well, they had a garrison of a brigade headquarters and two battalions. I think we were there, A, because there was somewhere to put us, and secondly, we did have a sort of internal security road to support the RUC if there was a, as indeed happened a few years later, a sort of a restart of IRA trouble. So there I had to not keep going, make touch my hat to various, sorry, Royal Ulster Constabulary people. It was just peacetime soldiering, and very pleasant it was too.
Did you have good exercise and training facilities?
Well, we had jolly good barracks for start, plenty of quarters. We had a good chap called Monkey Black, who was a pretty switched on chap actually, but he played it very well. He was a great hunting man, so he spent most of his time hunting down with a limerick in Southern Ireland, but he'd appear every now and again, set us a test exercise, and if that went satisfactorily, leave me alone. Really, I got on very well with him.
Were you concentrating on any particular aspect?
Well, I was training on individual training, really. Mm. I knew it was going to be a brigade exercise involving a river crossing, so I obviously did a couple of river crossing exercises myself. But most of the time was really, I mean, the battalion was so weak. I was very individual training and training up the support weapons and specialists and things. And then the situation then in 64 was the British Army was so it was deployed all over the world with Borneo, the Cameroons, there was Aden. Brigade headquarters went off to Aden. And unfortunately, I'd had only two companies strong. I couldn't go. The pity that I had a letter from Monkey Black saying, it's pity you're not out here, John. This is just right up your street. But anyway, so we just sort of hung around there. And then it got. And then I had to go to the MOD for briefing. It looked like having to go to Swaziland.
Swaziland? What on earth was going on?
Well, it was
Naya
situation there of some sort.
Yes.
Then it was changed to British Guiana.
Yes.
And we were all ready. I had to have one company ready to go. Then one Friday morning, I was tend to send this company off to British Guiana. So I left with one company again. So I thought, oh my God. I guess just hang about the rest of my tour in Northern Ireland. The situation in British Guiana got worse, and on the following Monday morning, I was rung up by the War Office at about 6 in the morning and said, look, you're off. Rest of your battalion. Mm. And we were airborne by 2 o'clock. Mind you, we got everybody ready. It's quite good in a way because it happened so quickly that all the sort of all the wives and all their own legs hadn't got time to think of an excuse. You're on the plane, boy. And so off we went, leaving my wife behind with all sorts, the CEO's wife and all sorts of problems, and a band and a small rear party.
What was the situation in British Guiana? When you were briefed before the first company that went out was sent there, what did they tell you about
what was going on? Still a British Crown colony.
Yes.
They'd been told they could have independence. Just a question that they would have to have elections. The British felt they had an obligation that elections were done without duress or violence. Mm. And the population was split really between the descendants of the freed African slaves and the descendants of the Indian indentured labour who'd been brought in after that slave emancipation. And they're about equal numbers. The Indians were led by a chap called Chedi Jagan, who was a high principled idealist. And the black element were led by Forbes Burnham, who was a practical shit.
Which one do you think would have made the
trouble, really? Ideologically, of course, Chetty Jagan was not the chap, but as a man, he was far superior to Forbes Burnham. Anyway, the situation was that, there was tremendous tension, that the blacks were running amok and killing a lot of Indians. And there was one battalion out there already.
Who were they?
They were the Buffs, Queen's Own Buffs, mm-hmm. and there was a full colonel commanding, and he would, and the governor asked for another battalion, so we went out. And there was, my first company went out ahead. I mean, they landed there, and they were put on a boat to steam up Demerara, straight off the boat after about 40 years. So we're up to a place called Mackenzie, about 70 miles up the Demerara, where there was a huge bauxite mine, where the blacks had just about killed every Indian. And there was, it was a Canadian company, Denver, it's a branch of Allcan, but there was a fear that they might not end there, and they'd start going for quite a considerable number of white families and things. As indeed they might, but anyway, I had a good company commander, he sorted that lot out. Then we arrived, and then another part. So I had another my second company with me. They also went to quite a tough area. It was all trouble based on sugar estates.
Was that inland or along the coast? Was that inland or along
no,
the coast?
No, it was on what was called the West Coast Demerara, which is the area to the west of the Demerara River, but it's the coastal area. It's where all the sugar plantations. British Guiana then, I think it still is now, it has a small coastal area developed largely by the Dutch with dikes and things like that. And that goes about 30 miles inland. And after that, you've got nothing else but tropical rainforest. And you get right to the south, you're up onto the savannas of Central North America or Northern South. So, but we were operating in almost entirely in the sugar plantation area, because that's where the main trouble was between the two groups.
That would be the main inhabited area, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry?
That would be the area where where the population was concentrated.
Oh, yes, the rest of it was nothing. There was a few just Amerindians and people, but that's where the population... We were based on Georgetown. Mm. Then the situation got even worse, and so, as I hadn't got a third company, they sent a gunner battery out to become my third company, and they were put under my command.
Did they settle in and perform effectively?
Yeah, no problem. Well, I tell my chaps, look, as far as I'm concerned, they'll be treated exactly the same as if they were our third company. If I find any reports of any not doing that, it would incur my displeasure. So it worked very well, we had no problem at all, they were jolly good, actually. And they played their part, they treated it worked very well.
What sort of operations were you actually conducting in order to deal with the situation?
Well, you see, we weren't up against any form of insurrection, it wasn't an insurrection against the British at all. What we had to do was prevent the blacks carving up the browns, in other words, the Negro descendant, the Negro element, carving up the Indian element. The Negroes tended to be idle, but tough physically. The Indians were more industrious, but not quite so tough. And it was wasn't entirely that, because the Indians did do a certain amount of, when they were quite certain they'd get away with it. It was really, the main thing was to stop this, making these people think that they were, make sure they wouldn't get away with it. And secondly, restoring confidence in the local population. We were basically in support of the police, so it was very important that we got on with the police, as indeed we did. And in fact, the Commissioner of Police became a personal friend of mine. He's dead now, but I mean, so, but we got again, it's one of the lessons one had learnt from Kenya and places that you've got to get on with the police, and even if it's difficult. And so, my officers they come and say, oh, I'm fine. I say, well, that's bad luck, mate, that's the burden you've got to bear.
Well,
What did they find difficult about dealing with the police?
Well, actually, the British government police were super. But occasionally, they tended to be a little bit parochial in their views. That was all. But basically, my company, they got on very well at every level. We had no problem with the police at all. In fact, the police actually turned me off. They were the best battalion ever been there, which is quite a compliment. I don't think it's true. But they're looking from an Arab point of view, because we didn't give them any trouble.
What were you actually doing? Were you doing patrols? Were you guarding vital points? What sort of actual operations did you do on the ground?
I mean, each company had a vast area, about as big as Devon.
Yes.
And the platoons were detached down there, just patrolling. So platoon commanders had quite a responsible job, because they had not only, they had their own local security to look after. The platoon commander had to do all the patrolling, work all that out, and he administered his platoon. I mean, the platoon commanders had a smashing time. They really learned a lot.
What sort of patrols were you mounting? What sort of scale?
Again, they were populatic patrols, just patrolling around the villages. To really reassure the locals. And with one exception, they never... the sight of British soldiers with bayonets was enough to fix bayonets. They never... and then, as we gradually established things quietened down, we then spent a lot of time training. Each little village had its own home guard. They weren't armed, but not with firearms. But they were organised to have sentries out and people like that, and then a system of communication so they could telephone or. To us, so we could send out an immediate help. The basic thing really was to restore public confidence, get a stable enough situation so that elections could take place without any sort of duress.
When the trouble had been going on before you arrived, had the troublemakers been attacking property as well as people, or was it mainly selective murder?
I mean, in this place, Mackenzie, where they not only killed as many Indians as they could, they torched their buildings, having looted and torched them. I mean, they're black Africa. I quite like them, actually. I mean, I know racial attack, but they'd have a few rums and things like that. They'd just give berserk. But again, once a British patrol sort of turned up and they suddenly saw a whole line of soldiers there, we only had one occasion where they did attack a soldier, that was all.
What happened on that occasion?
Well, that was much later on, and this was, apart from the stress, the conflict between the Ligos and the Indians, there was a certain area to the west, to the east, where there were very huge rice grain. And this was dominated by a chap called Pandit Tiwari, who was an Indian, but he was also a communist. And the Communist Party element there wanted to create such unrest and stuff that it wouldn't be possible to hold elections, the usual business of trying to create anarchy. So he and his sort of gangs tried to stop the rice harvest going on. And so I gave a recce platoon commander, who happened to be a chap called, who finished up as a full general, General Sir John Woolsey,
Indeed.
He was my recce platoon commander. So one of his roles, he had another role, one of his roles was to keep this area quiet. He had the other role, which was to prevent gun smuggling from Dutch Guyana next door. Anyway, he became a very good corporal who was down there, and the harvest was going on very satisfactorily. The patrols out watching, no interference. And then one day, the smallest little driver in the whole section, two chaps came up and sort of went for him, attacked, or went